For Politico, I'm Ryan Heath. This time was supposed to be different. Through a combination of rapid private sector innovation, large doses of public funding, and a novel partnership called COVAX, COVID vaccines were supposed to be in the arms of hundreds of millions of Africans by now. The African Union, a club of more than 50 African countries, kind of like an early stage EU, threw itself into the task, lining up Zimbabwe's billionaire tech CEO, Strive Masiwa, to run their vaccine effort. So what happened? How are vaccines going to waste, unused and unwanted in rich Western countries, while Africans, who desperately want the vaccine, can't get it? Less than 10% of Africans are vaccinated today, nowhere near where the African Union expected to be. They plan for more than half the continent to be vaccinated by now. To find out what went wrong, Global Insider went straight to the man in charge, Strive Masiwa.
The target was set by the African Union heads of state in August 2020. And at that time, we had been led to believe that there was a global initiative called COVAX, in which all the poor nations would get a fair access to the vaccines when they became available. So initially, you know, I thought my job would just be to coordinate what comes in and making sure that, you know, they're going to the right places on time. But when we met with the COVAX leadership to get an understanding of how it was all to work, and of course, the first thing I asked them is, listen, our target is 60%, so how much do you think we're going to get? Oh, they said 5 to 20% max. The U.S. government at that time wasn't really engaging. So the focus really was on the Europeans. And after some discussions with President Ramaphosa and President Macron and the leaders of the key countries at the time, Egypt, Nigeria, Kenya, and so forth, there were 10 leaders. President Macron agreed to canvass the other leaders in the European Union. And they came back and they said, listen, we'll back the COVAX initiative to meet you halfway. Let's make this a 50-50 partnership. You guys get half the vaccines yourself and we will get the other half for you. We obviously went to all the vaccine manufacturers. This would have been about November as the progress on vaccines were coming through, you know, AstraZeneca.
Yeah, we'd had the successful trials at this point, but we weren't getting the emergency authorization yet.
Yeah, sure. So we were looking at that time that we would engage the suppliers. And to our shock and surprise, they told us, actually, you know, sorry to tell you this, but we've already sold the vaccine production for 2021. We said, there's nothing available. They said, there is nothing available. We went from manufacturer to manufacturer. And that's when we realized that we had a serious problem because the manufacturers were telling us that they had sold the vaccines to the wealthiest industrialized countries. And so there would be nothing for us, even if we had money to buy the vaccines.
If I can interrupt you for 1 second, just on that specific point, I was at a dinner last night in Washington, D.C., and it was honoring the CEOs of both Pfizer and BioNTech for their scientific and their humanitarian achievements of the past year, in the sense of a vaccine that has helped save millions of lives. And one of the things they talked about was committing to ensuring 1 billion doses of the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine going to the poorest countries in the world in 2022. How does that honor and that commitment sound to you after your experience of not being able to access much of these vaccines this year?
Look, you know, it's not my place to question any honors to any specific suppliers, because I don't think it's an issue of the suppliers. Basically, what we understood to be equity, equitable treatment, is obviously not the way the rich nations looked at it. From the perspective of the rich nations, it meant we get them first. And when we've done with saving our own people, we will then attend to you. We thought that vaccines would become available. We all understood that initially production levels would be limited and that there would have to be a way to deliver vaccines so that we got first to the healthcare workers, then we'd get to the elderly, then we would work through the most vulnerable people on a global basis. We ourselves, as the Africans, we had our own money. We raised money. We were ready to buy vaccines.
That's actually a misunderstanding a lot of people in the United States have, that it's not well understood that you don't just want donations. You were willing to pay for these vaccines, but you're not able to get them, including because there are export bans in countries like the U.S.
Exactly. And you know, when you look at it in terms of donations, okay, at the end of the day, vaccines are not expensive. We might be poor, but we are not without something. We have the continent of Africa has a GDP of 2.5 trillion. It is the same as the GDP of India. We can go out and buy vaccines. And we had $2 billion cash to buy vaccines. And we went to the Pfizers and the Modernas and so forth, and they said, there is nothing available in 2021, which meant we were forced to the back of the queue. Okay, that is the reality. Now, the only vaccines we managed to access were the Johnson & Johnson vaccines. And the reason for that is that Johnson & Johnson had one of its plants for its global supply chain in South Africa. It wasn't intended that those vaccines would be for Africa. It was intended that it was part of their global supply chain. And we were then able to literally arm twist them to say, well, look, how can you produce on the African continent and ship to Europe? Because if you remember, there was actually a row between South Africa and Europe over this issue, to say, how can you accept an arrangement whereby vaccines produced in Africa are shipped to Europe while Africa has no vaccines? Okay, then Europe sort of pulled back and said, okay, you can have what's produced there. Initially, they said, you can have 50%. We said, no. We're paying for these vaccines. We're not asking anyone for a donation. We're paying for them. Moderna was not available in Africa. Because whenever we went to Moderna, they said, we have a contract to ship all our vaccines into the U.S. for the U.S. people. So we then went to the White House and we said, listen, since you've vaccinated your people, you've got the vaccines, how about letting us get to the counter and just delay some of your own purchases for just a quarter, 3-4 months. So we can get some vaccines. So we didn't get a donation from the United States. We did a queue swap. We came from the back of the queue to get to the front of the queue so we can buy. We'd never been allowed to get to the counter to actually buy.
And that took place in 2021 under the new Biden administration.
Yeah. It took place 2-3 weeks ago.
Oh, okay.
So that was the first time we really were allowed to the counter to buy vaccines not produced on the African continent.
Well, that actually gets us to the question of decentralized production in a way. So there's this one factory in South Africa that is capable of producing vaccines. I wanted to get your reflections on whether more should have been done commercially or at a government level to expand that production capacity, you know, a year or 18 months ago, and we knew we were going to need more of these vaccines. And also what you think of that South African project now to reverse engineer some of the vaccines so that they can be made generically at the factory in South Africa.
Look, the issue of vaccine production is not rocket science here. The problem we have is very simple. The donor community created an institution called Gavi. And they gave Gavi money each year to buy vaccines. So they buy vaccines and they distribute them. This is before COVID, The problem with that is it had an unintended consequence. The unintended consequence was that Gavi would go to India, buy vaccines in India, and distribute them in Africa for free, which meant that African manufacturers could not get into the game because who is the customer? Well, the customer says, I buy in India. Okay, so as a result, there's an industrial vaccine production complex in India which was supposed to serve everybody else.
And then the Delta variant comes along and completely disrupts that supply arrangement because whereas they had intended to export the majority of what they were producing there, the Indian government did what naturally a national government is going to have to do in that situation and say, Delta is out of control in India, we need those doses for us. And then that obviously has the knock-on effect of messing up whatever access you in Africa would have to those doses.
That's exactly what happened, Ryan. And I was right in the middle of those discussions. So come March, COVAX was saying, we'll deliver to you 700 million vaccines this year to meet 35% of your 30% of your population by the end of the year. And these vaccines are coming from India. We said, no, we've got no problem with that. But once we sat down with India, we began to realize that India was also beginning to develop a nationalist approach to the production assets. Okay. And once the Delta variant broke out, India closed the door. So the COVAX initiative fell over. There was no more vaccines.
Take us into that room. What was it that discussion like? You had it directly with people from the Indian government, or you had it through the UN officials and the people who work with COVAX?
No, we met with the Indian officials. We met because we knew how serious it was for our continent. We met with COVAX. We had African foreign ministers. I was in there. We were in there, and we were saying, listen, to COVAX, we don't see where your vaccines are coming from. India has a population of 1.4 billion, just like us. By the time they get through their population, there's going to be a problem here. This is before Delta. And when we sat with the Indian diplomats at the African Union, we absolutely were, it was alarm bells everywhere as we realized that the COVAX deliveries out of these huge Indian factories would not come through. You know, there are factories in Europe, there are factories in America, there are factories in Japan and South Korea. So I'm not going to beat up on India. You know, the bottom line is those who had the production assets are the ones who could vaccinate their people. So if we're going to look forward, it's not by creating distribution structures like COVAX. It is accepting what happens in a crisis of this nature and ensuring that there are production assets on the ground to meet our own region. And that also means fixing the whole Gavi structure.
Then really the time is now to start building up the expertise and the sophisticated equipment that is needed to produce vaccines. Would you agree that that work needs to be happening now so that whenever the next variant comes or the next pandemic hits, Africa is not relying on either these distribution structures or generosity of some kind from others?
I've met with UNICEF, I've met with Gavi, and I've demanded that they must change the way they procure vaccines to ensure that production is not offshored out of Africa. There's 6 million jobs that are supporting vaccine and other generic production in India for the African continent. Well, we can't go back there. We have to have production on the African continent. So we are now having conversations around this to say to the vaccine production companies like Johnson & Johnson, listen, we will support you to produce from Africa. We're not after their IP. Okay, that for me is not my discussion. If Johnson & Johnson wants to produce from Africa, which they say they will, and they're 100% owned and is their IP, good for them. Mercedes-Benz produces cars from Africa. So, you know, it's not as if we can't do this stuff.
And what is a realistic timeline there? You know, for example, we've heard Moderna commit that they would build a factory in Africa, but we don't have any details on that. When do you think a Johnson & Johnson or another manufacturer could realistically have a factory up and running? If they were all in today, when could be day one of that operation in practice?
No, we've been going into this in great detail with them. We've asked them to license Aspen Pharmaceuticals in South Africa, who are already producing the vaccine. They can produce 250 million a year, and they are prepared to produce under license. They are prepared to invest additional money if the demand side is sorted out. So by the end of January, we expect to be receiving 40 million doses a month of just the Johnson & Johnson vaccine produced in Africa. Now, what you then want to do is to deepen the production process into substance production, that sort of thing. But at the end of the day, a vaccine is produced, requires inputs from many parts of the world. There's a lot of things we have to fix before we can say we are self-sufficient in it, but it's not beyond us if we fix some of the fundamental issues.
And it's likely, I'm guessing, that the African Union will have to make the market in some respects, that you have these discussions with Gavi about further expanding the market, but you might need to be the initial seed for creating that demand that allows the production.
Oh, yes, that's what we've done. We've created the Africa Vaccine Acquisition Trust, which is a pool buying mechanism. We have 43 members in Africa, 7 countries from the Caribbean. We all got together. We've been buying together. We want to make sure that going forward, we have legacy assets of our own to take out of this and similar tragedies.
I wanted to ask about the situation with vaccine hesitancy in Africa, where we know from other data sets and other conditions and viruses that Africans actually have the largest support usually for vaccines of any continent. And we've seen some truly unusual reasons and concerns that people in other continents have expressed about why they don't want COVID vaccines. What's the situation in Africa? What are some of the surprising reasons or concerns you've heard people expressing about vaccines?
Look, vaccine hesitancy is a global concern. It's a concern in the United States, as it is in Germany, as it is in Japan or anywhere else in the world. But, you know, for me, that isn't my issue at the moment, because we know from our own surveys, okay, that at least 50% of our people want a vaccine. Well, let me get to those 50% first, okay? I'm not worrying about the people who don't want vaccines, whilst there are millions who do.
And let me ask you about the big risks of not getting this vaccination rate up to a much higher number in Africa.
Well, look, obviously, as you rightly noted, Ryan, from the point when antiretrovirals first became available in the West to when they arrived in Africa, it was 8 years. And it is estimated that we lost 10 million people with a miracle drug, and yet we couldn't get it. And, you know, we are grateful that when President George W. Bush finally addressed it with the PEPFAR program, we could eventually begin to get over this issue. Now, when you're having to lock down the poorest people who live on $2 a day, the economic, social, mental health issues and social cohesion are horrendous. Never mind the loss of life for a moment. So we are beginning to see a lot of issues which I think are being amplified by this, particularly rising tensions, conflicts that we hadn't seen for a very long time.
Do you mean in terms of civil conflicts like what we see in Ethiopia or?
Absolutely. These things are being amplified. And I'm not saying that that is the reason for it, okay? But we've had 5 or 6 coups in just the last 18 months, which is more than I've seen in a generation. Now, is this a causality? I am not a social scientist. We'll know in due course. But certainly the economic stress on our people, when you consider the fact that we have no stimulus packages, we cannot help people. And that's why we've called out to the global community to say, use the IMF to help us create stimulus instruments. And we campaigned hard for this. All the top economists thought this is what you should be using the IMF to do in a time such as this. You guys, we read, you've put in trillions of dollars. We understand that amongst the leading Western nations, you're over $20 trillion in stimulus support programs. We've had $32 billion for a population of 1.3 billion.
That must make very real the risk that instead of convergence between African economies and developed economies, that instead of this catch-up, Africa might actually fall further behind as a result of COVID's impacts.
Absolutely. That's reality now. We, after seeing a good 20, 25 years in which we saw some of the fastest growing economies in the world as African economies, in stability, 5% growth across the continent with an really small number of conflicts, it's exploding. We really need those global economic leaders to really revisit this. Otherwise, the challenges will become totally tragic for everybody.
Given all of those extra challenges that you've had in 2021, what is your new goal for 2022?
Look, we take the view we held in our meeting today. We said, look, let's go with what we are in control of. We appreciate the US announcements and the donations that are going to come. We appreciate that. But we're not in control of when they come or how they come. We are responsible to our own populations. And what we can do is to use our own meager resources, buy vaccines, deliver them. We know we are comfortable now that from our own efforts, we should achieve about 35-40% of our population by September. It's better late than never. This time, we're a year behind the rest of the world in getting the first round of vaccines in. And when donations arrive, we will be appreciative. And we know, for instance, that the United States government has been a game changer with the new administration in terms of trying to help. But we're still waiting for a lot of that promised help to come through. But at the end of the day, we ourselves must help ourselves, and we are willing to. We said, let's meet halfway. It was our proposal. We didn't ask for donations. We just said, let's meet halfway. You know our economic challenges, but we are willing to help ourselves. Just allow us access to the resources, access to the technology, and access to the distribution mechanism.
Strive Masiwa, thank you so much for joining us and being a Global Insider.
Thank you so much, Ryan. Appreciate you.
Olivia Rheingold produces this show. Our editor and executive producer of audio is Irene Noguchi. I'm Ryan Heath. Subscribe to this podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. We'll be back next Wednesday with another episode of Global Insider.